Welcome. We come tonight to Chapter 8, The Supreme Will, in the first section of Synthesis of Yoga, Part 1, shall we say, the Yoga of Divine Works and the Synthesis of Yoga. The Supreme Will, which had been revised from its original appearance in the Arya in 1932, and then some of the later stages of that chapter in the revision were lost. Sri Aurobindo had to come back and recast that, so he actually revised this chapter at least twice. We'll have a look at that missing set of pages on another occasion. But we see here a continuation of them, a long argument that he's making. He began with the four aids, then described what is the nature of the self-consecration, how we take the stuff of our life centered around our soul and make it sacred by an intimate communion with the divine consciousness. Then, once we establish that inwardness, we must pour it out into work. We can't simply be satisfied with an inner state of communion, but we must express it actively. And how do we express our surrender to the divine in work except through a progressive karma yoga? And then he describes what is the nature of that movement in life at all three levels of our being, in the bodily life, in our active life, in our affective and emotional life, and of course in our mental self-giving as well. This culminates in two consecutive chapters, the ascent of the sacrifice, and he gets back to the root of the idea that what we are surrendering is a gift of our being, and as we offer it, we use that very gift as a means of self-elevation, that we come into a space beyond the dualities and the temporalities of time, and we arrive in the eternity of the Spirit. The sacrifice is not simply Vedic, but is here and now. We shouldn't think of this as only a relic of the past that Sri Aurobindo is interpreting into our consideration for the practice of yoga. It is an eternal, a recurring phenomenon. Whatever the clime, whatever the country, this same elevation of the human spirit into communion with the divine is possible. So then, if that is so, and we can live beyond the demands of mind and philosophy and the ordering of life according to religion and morality, what is that? So he discussed the standards of conduct in spiritual freedom and arrived at that ultimate position that the Gita declared in its final chapter in the 66th verse. Abandon all dharmas and come to me alone. I will deliver you from grief and suffering. Do not grieve. In the abandonment of all of the ordinary human demands upon us, Sri Aurobindo has accorded to the human a position of identity with the Supreme Person, and that divine person can live through us if we have surrendered our nature. That means body, life, and mind in attunement with the soul, given wholly to the Supreme, and finding there that the one who is above all is in all and stands at the center of our own nature. That is what gives you the power to not live according to the demands and the customs of lower life, but to live in the freedom of the spirit. One has to have that experience of oneness. That is what frees one to get to the essence of truth, the essence of being. So that's a very rapid summary of where we've been so far in the Yoga of Divine Works. So now, Chapter 8, the Supreme Will. In the light of this progressive manifestation of the Spirit, first apparently bound in the ignorance, then free in the power and wisdom of the Infinite, we can better understand the great and crowning injunction of the Gita to the Karma Yogin. Abandoning all dharmas, all principles and laws and rules of conduct, take refuge in me alone. All standards and rules are temporary constructions founded upon the needs of the ego and its transition from matter to spirit. These makeshifts have a relative imperativeness so long as we rest satisfied in the stages of transition, content with the physical and vital life, attached to the mental movement, or even fixed in the ranges of the mental plane that are touched by the spiritual lusters. But beyond is the unwalled wideness of a supramental infinite consciousness, and there all temporary structures cease. It is not possible to enter utterly into the spiritual truth of the eternal and infinite if we have not the faith and courage to trust ourselves into the hands of the Lord of all things and the friend of all creatures, and leave utterly behind us our mental limits and measures. And of course, all of this is redolent of the passages in the Gita. Who is the Lord of all things? The Ishvara. What is it that we bring to this? Faith. Faith is Shraddha. Courage. The courage born of the soul. At one moment, we must plunge, without hesitation, reserve, fear, or scruple, into the ocean of the free, the infinite, the absolute. After the law, liberty. After the personal, after the general, after the universal standards, there is something greater, the impersonal plasticity, the divine freedom, the transcendent force, and the supernal impulse. After the straight path of the ascent, the wide plateaus on the summit. We may note that the Ishvara, the Lord, as we translate it into English, is defined as by the Gita as being at the center of all beings, turning all beings as if mounted upon a machine. So the deity is deeply inside. The deity may be distinct from us, at least in appearance, at least in manifestation, in the gunas of the world that we inhabit, but is essentially one with us. So both unity and difference are there. The Ishvara is an ideal to be achieved in life, to be free, to be impersonal, to be seated in that vast spiritual consciousness, and yet to be regnant in life, to rule in life, not to be pushed around by nature, but in a sense to be sovereign. So if the divine king establishes itself on earth as the ruler, as the king of a kingdom, it does so through the instrumentality of the Dharma. But the Dharma should always express the eternal truths of what that is. The temporal dharmas that we create, the human standards that emulate that, are not final standards. They have to be set aside at some point. But the king, that is to say, the awakened soul, ruler of the nature, sovereign over his own being, embodies social order, responsible behavior in the world, not simply in human society, but in all of nature, green and wild and oceanic and all the rest. As an extension of the divine, and of course in ancient India that would have been done through ritual consecration. There again, the idea of a consecration comes into it. Of course, in the old days, one did it ritualistically. Sri Aurobindo insists that this is an inner occasion. This is an inner event. But one way or the other, Dharma is established, and it is an obligation on the created being who is unaware of his essence, but it is a free action when one becomes aware of the essence. And then one lives on those wide plateaus on the summit. One has to gain that ascent, the straight path of the ascent of the sacrifice. It restores us to union with that and makes unnecessary the conducts of morality, telling us how to do this, when to do that, etc. We are governed by ritual. We are governed by society's demands until we are truly inwardly free. There are three stages of the ascent. At the bottom, the bodily life enslaved to the pressure of necessity and desire. In the middle, the mental, higher emotional, and psychic rule that feels after greater interests, aspirations, experiences. At the summits, first, a deeper psychic and spiritual state, and then a supramental eternal consciousness in which all our aspirations and seekings discover their own intimate significance. In the bodily life, first desire and need, and then the practical good of the individual and the society are the governing consideration, the dominant force. In the mental life, ideas and ideals rule, ideas that are half-lights wearing the garb of truth, ideals formed by the mind as a result of a growing but still imperfect intuition and experience. Whenever the mental life prevails and the bodily diminishes its brute insistence, man, the mental being, feels pushed by the urge of mental nature to mold in the sense of the idea or the ideal the life of the individual, and in the end, even the vaguer, more complex life of the society is forced to undergo this subtle process. In the spiritual life, or when a higher power than mind has manifested and taken possession of the nature, these limited motive forces recede, dwindle, tend to disappear. The spiritual or supramental self, the divine being, the supreme and immanent reality, must be alone the Lord within us and shape freely our final development according to the highest, widest, most integral expression possible of the law of our nature. In the end, that nature acts in the perfect truth and its spontaneous freedom, for it obeys only the luminous power of the eternal. The individual has nothing further to gain, no desire to fulfill. He has become a portion of the impersonality or the universal personality of the eternal. No other object than the manifestation and play of the divine spirit in life and the maintenance and conduct of the world in its march towards the divine goal can move him to action. Mental ideas, opinions, constructions are his no more. For his mind has fallen into silence. It is only a channel for the light and truth of the divine knowledge. Ideas are too narrow for the vastness of his spirit. It is the ocean of the infinite that flows through him and moves him forever. This is autobiographical. This was Sri Aurobindo's being. He was lifted out of that limited egoistic placement into the largeness of the spirit. In a silent mind from 1908 on, never had to think. Ideas could come pouring themselves into him if he wished to receive them. But he never had to think. He never had to look for a lower truth. Higher truths came to him, unbidden. We've talked a lot about the Bhagavad Gita in relationship to this book, but we should note that centuries before the Gita was composed, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad spoke of a supreme Lord Maheshwara who was the cause of the cosmos, who manifested the cosmos through the power, the Shakti of his own being. And yet, although transcendent to the cosmos, dwelt within it, immanent inside the world and in all beings. And it was our duty, in a sense, to practice yoga to reach union with that. So this, centuries before the Gita, and one of the earliest mentions of yoga in the annals of Indian spiritual history. Of course, there's the Katha Upanishad as well. But this is an idea that, of course, the Gita expands upon, and which is core to Sri Aurobindo's experience. He was not led by these texts to recognize these truths. But having realized these truths, he then recognized in the texts their relevance. Let's move on a little farther. Whoever sincerely enters the path of works must leave behind him the stage in which need and desire are the first law of our acts. For whatever desires still trouble his being, he must, if he accepts the high aim of yoga, put them away from him into the hands of the Lord within us. The supreme power will deal with them for the good of the sadhaka and for the good of all. In effect, we find that once this surrender is done, always provided the rejection is sincere, egoistic indulgence of desire may for some time recur under the continued impulse of past nature, but only in order to exhaust its acquired momentum and to teach the embodied being in his most unteachable part, his nervous, vital, emotional nature, by the reactions of desire, by its grief and unrest, bitterly contrasted with calm periods of the higher peace, or marvelous movements of divine ananda, that egoistic desire is not a law for the soul that seeks liberation or aspires to its own original God nature. Afterwards, the element of desire in those impulsions will be thrown away or persistently eliminated by a constant denying and transforming pressure. Only the pure force of action in them, pravritti, justified by an equal delight in all work and result that is inspired or imposed from above, will be preserved in the happy harmony of a final perfection. To act, to enjoy, is the normal law and right of the nervous being, but to choose by personal desire its action and enjoyment is only its ignorant will, not its right. Alone, the supreme and universal will must choose. Action must change into a dynamic movement of that will. Enjoyment must be replaced by the play of a pure spiritual ananda. All personal will is either a temporary delegation from on high or a usurpation by the ignorant asura. This is something that was noted about Sri Aurobindo by his attendants, that he never asked for anything. He did not impose his will. If tea was brought, he drank it. If food was brought, he ate it. He didn't say, go get this, go get that. Once he expressed a little annoyance when all the clocks, all the timepieces in all of his rooms stopped working at one moment. And he had a habit of looking at the clocks to see what time it was, because he, in a sense, ordinated his active yoga according to hours, according to the rhythms of nature. They all stopped. And he looked and he said, this is not funny. This is not amusing. Suddenly, they all began to work instantly. Tick, tick, tick. He had spoken. Champaklal, I think, noted that only in the last days of Sri Aurobindo's life did he make a request. He asked for a glass of water. He was thirsty. The social law, that second term of our progress, is a means to which the ego is subjected in order that it may learn discipline by subordination to a wider collective ego. This law may be quite empty of any moral content and may express only the needs or the practical good of the society as each society conceives it. Or it may express those needs and that good, but modified and colored and supplemented by a higher moral or ideal law. It is binding on the developing, but not yet perfectly developed individual in the shape of social duty, family obligation, communal or national demand, so long as it is not in conflict with his growing sense of the higher right. But the sadhaka of the karma yoga will abandon this also to the Lord of Works. After he has made this surrender, his social impulses and judgments will, like his desires, only be used for their exhaustion, or it may be, so far as they are still necessary for a time to enable him to identify his lower mental nature with mankind in general, or with any grouping of mankind in its works and hopes and aspirations. But after that brief time is over, they will be withdrawn, and a divine government will alone abide. He will be identified with the divine and with others only through the divine consciousness and not through the mental nature. So again, here's an equivalence between the awakened spirit who becomes Lord of the law of his nature, identified with the Lord above. So the Raja within is the Raja above. And the king is a direct manifestation of the gods, and society expresses the cosmic body of this ruling Purusha in a world made commonly one with the divine. So you can see this rulership, this self-government in the divine consciousness, begins with the individual, but it could definitely have social impact if there were a spiritual society. Right now, Sri Aurobindo is talking about the alignment of an aspiring soul with the supreme will. Might it not also be possible for a Gnostic society to live and express that supreme will? Well, for even after he is free, he continues, the Sataka will be in the world, and to be in the world is to remain in works. We're never excused from action in the cosmos. But to remain in works without desire is to act for the good of the world in general, or for the kind, or the race, or for some new creation to be evolved on the earth, or some work imposed by the divine will within him. Again, the concept of loka sangraha, the holding together of the worlds, the holding together of the peoples mentioned in the Gita. And in fact, this resonates back to the Dharma literature in general in India, that one acts to protect the people, to maintain the order, and to administer justice. This is what one expects from the ruler. This is what one should do in ruling one's own nature. This is what one should do in extending outward to serve the larger society. But we insist on doing it not by edict, not by ethical command, but by the spontaneous movement of the spirit inside. The soul, in consonance with the supreme will, knows what to do. And this must be done either in the framework provided by the environment or the grouping in which he is born or placed, or else in one which is chosen or created for him by a divine direction. Therefore, in our perfection, there must be nothing left in the mental being which conflicts with or prevents our sympathy and free self-identification with the kind, the group, or whatever collective expression of the divine he is meant to lead, help, or serve. But in the end, it must become a free self-identification through identity with the divine, and not a mental bond or moral tie of union or a vital association dominated by any kind of personal, social, national, communal, or creedal egoism. If any social law is obeyed, it will not be from physical necessity or from the sense of personal or general interest or for expediency, or because of the pressure of the environment, or from any sense of duty, but solely for the sake of the Lord of works, and because it is felt or known to be the divine will that the social law or rule or relation as it stands can still be kept as a figure of the inner life, and the minds of men must not be disturbed by its infringement. So we can see the inner significance of taking an action like that, especially if it redounds to the benefit and the maintenance of the whole, if it indeed moves forward the Sanatana Dharma, the eternal way. If, on the other hand, the social law, rule, or relation is disregarded, that too will not be for the indulgence of desire, personal will, or personal opinion, but because a greater rule is felt that expresses the law of the spirit, or because it is known that there must be in the march of the divine all will a movement towards the changing, exceeding, or abolition of existing laws and forms for the sake of a freer, larger life necessary to the world's progress. There is still left the moral law or the ideal, and these, even to many who think themselves free, appear forever sacred and intangible. But the sadhaka, his gaze turned always to the heights, will abandon them to him whom all ideals seek imperfectly and fragmentarily to express. All moral qualities are only a poor and rigid travesty of his spontaneous and illimitable perfection. The bondage to sin and evil passes away with the passing of nervous desire, for it belongs to the quality of vital passion, impulsion, or drive of propensity in us, rajoguna, and is extinguished with the transformation of that mode of nature, the transformation of rajas into tapas, into a higher order of energy and power. But neither must the aspirant remain subject to the gilded or golden chain of a conventional or a habitual or a mentally ordered or even a high or clear sattvic virtue. That will be replaced by something profounder and more essential than the minor inadequate thing that men call virtue. The original sense of the word was manhood, and this is a much larger and deeper thing than the moral mind and its structures. The culmination of karma yoga is a yet higher and deeper state that may perhaps be called soulhood, for the soul is greater than the man. A free soulhood spontaneously welling out in works of a supreme truth and love will replace human virtue. But this supreme truth cannot be forced to inhabit the petty edifices of the practical reason, or even confined in the more dignified constructions of the larger ideative reason that imposes its representations as if they were pure truth on the limited human intelligence. This supreme love will not necessarily be consistent, much less will it be synonymous with the partial and feeble, ignorant and emotion-ridden movements of human attraction, sympathy, and pity. The petty law cannot bind the vaster movement. The mind's partial attainment cannot dictate its terms to the soul's supreme fulfillment. So even if we change the rajasic and the sattvic parts of our being so far as they're able to imbibe and receive the spiritual force and glow, they won't be ultimately changed. They have to undergo a greater transformation, and their divine corollaries, in a sense, descend and replace them here. At first, the higher love and truth will fulfill its movement in the sadhaka according to the essential law or way of his own nature. Essential law or way of his nature, his swadharma and swabhava. Remember, that extends from above. In the language of the Gita, that flows out of the essence of the truth of the individual spirit, the jiva, as it is expressed by Prakriti at one with the Purushottama above. In other words, the Supreme's own nature radiates from its oneness, illimitable rays of individual eternal light. That is the core of our individuality. That is our Supreme nature. That Supreme nature embodies itself, Swabhava embodies itself in Swadharma here. That is the law that's governing the developing soul. The outer Dharma is a kind of covering which dimly expresses the truth of that Swadharma, which is expressing this truth of the Swabhava, which is the truth of the Jiva, which comes from the Purusha, above, the Supreme Person. So you see how that lengthy chain of manifestation funnels down and manifests here in the material world. For that is the special aspect of the divine nature, para prakriti, the maha shakti, out of which his soul has emerged into the play, not limited indeed by the forms of this law or way, for the soul is infinite. But still, its stuff of nature bears that stamp, evolves fluently along those lines, or turns around the spiral curves of that dominating influence. He will manifest the divine truth movement according to the temperament of the sage, or the lion-like fighter, or the lover and enjoyer, or the worker and servant, or in any combination of essential attributes, gunas, that may constitute the form given to his being by its own inner urge. So the soul force chooses the mode of its expression. And what he's just enumerated are, I guess you would say, the four colors of humanity, whether they're the knower, the Brahman, or the powerful actor in the world, the Kshatriya, or those who move through the gathering and distribution of wealth, the Vaishya, or those who delight in the service and undertaking all things for the benefit of another, the Shudra. All of these, by the way, express powers of the Divine Mother, as you'll know from having read the Mother. Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, Mahasaraswati. It is this self-nature playing freely in his acts which men will see in him, and not a conduct cut, chalked out, artificially regulated by any lesser rule or by any law from outside. This is a condition of spiritual anarchy. You don't need external laws to govern you and prevent you from not harming others. From within, all you do is a manifestation of beauty and delight and truth in action, and all you do is good to others. A true and real good that penetrates behind the appearances. But there is a yet higher attainment. There is an infinity, anantya, in which even this last limitation is exceeded, because the nature is utterly fulfilled and its boundaries vanish. There the soul lives without any boundaries, for it uses all forms and molds according to the divine will in it, but it is not restrained, it is not tied down, it is not imprisoned in any power or form that it uses. This is the summit of the path of works, and this the utter liberty of the soul in its actions. In reality, it has there no actions, for all its activities are a rhythm of the supreme and sovereignly proceed from that alone like a spontaneous music out of the infinite. This has so much of the book The Mother in it. Teaches to strength and force the rhythm that keeps the might of their acts harmonious and in measure, and casts on perfection the charm that makes it endure forever. From chapter 6. So it's a good place to put our bookmark, I think, and we'll continue with the Supreme Will next week. Or will we? Next week is the 17th of November, the day the mother left her body. Let's see. Shall we talk about the significance of her withdrawal, or shall we continue with the book? We'll determine that in the next few days. And then 2 weeks from today, of course, is the 24th. I think that evening we should give to Siddhi Day, and we won't certainly be covering the synthesis of yoga then. Perhaps for the next 2 weeks, we'll talk about other things on this evening. But tonight, book two in Savitri, the book of the traveler of the worlds, canto 5, the godheads of the little life. This begins on page, I think, 154. At the outset of this enigmatic world, which seems at once an enormous brute machine and a slow unmasking of the spirit in things, in this revolving chamber without walls, in which God sits impassive everywhere, as if unknown to himself and by us unseen, in a miracle of inconscient secrecy, yet is all here his action and his will. In this whirl and sprawl through infinite vacancy, the spirit became matter and lay in the whirl, a body sleeping without sense or soul. A mass phenomenon of visible shapes, supported by the silence of the void, appeared in the eternal consciousness and seemed an outward and insensible world. There was none there to see and none to feel, only the miraculous inconscient. A subtle wizard skilled was at its task, inventing ways for magical results, managing creation's marvelous device, marking mechanically dumb wisdom's points, using the unthought, inevitable idea. It did the works of God's intelligence, or wrought the will of some supreme unknown. Still, consciousness was hidden in nature's womb. Unfelt was the bliss whose rapture dreamed the worlds. Being was an inert substance driven by force. At first was only an etheric space. Its huge vibrations circled round and round, housing some unconceived initiative. Upheld by a supreme original breath, expansion and contraction's mystic act created touch and friction in the void, into abstract emptiness brought clash and clasp. Parent of an expanding universe in a matrix of disintegrating force, by spending it conserved an endless sum. On the hearth of space, it kindled a viewless fire that, scattering worlds as one might scatter seeds, whirled out the luminous order of the stars. an ocean of electric energy, formlessly formed its strange wave particles, constructing by their dance this solid scheme, its mightiness in the atom shut to rest. Masses were forged or feigned, and visible shapes. Light flung the photon's swift revealing spark, and showed in the minuteness of its flash, imaged this cosmos of apparent things. Thus has been made this real impossible world, an obvious miracle or convincing show, or so it seems to man's audacious mind, who seats his thought as the arbiter of truth, his personal vision as impersonal fact, as witnesses of an objective world, his erring sense and his instrument's artifice. Thus must he work life's tangible riddle out in a doubtful light, by error seize on truth, and slowly part the visage and the veil. Or else, forlorn of faith in mind and sense, his knowledge a bright body of ignorance, he sees in all things strangely fashioned here the unwelcome jest of a deceiving force, a parable of Maya and her might. This vast perpetual motion, caught and held in the mysterious and unchanging change of the persistent movement we call time, and ever renewing its recurrent beat, these mobile rounds that stereotype a flux, these static objects in the cosmic dance, that are but energy self-repeating whirls, prolonged by the spirit of the brooding void, awaited life and sense and waking mind. A little the dreamer changed his pose of stone. But when the inconscient's scrupulous work was done, and chance coerced by fixed immutable laws, a scene was set for nature's conscious play. Then stirred the spirit's mute, immobile sleep. The force concealed broke dumbly, slowly out. A dream of living woke in matter's heart. A will to live moved the inconscient's dust. A freak of living startled vacant time, ephemeral in a blank eternity, infinitesimal in a dead infinite. A subtler breath quickened dead matter's forms. The world's set rhythm changed to a conscious cry, a serpent power twinned the insensible force. Islands of living dotted lifeless space, and germs of living formed in formless air. A life was born that followed matter's law, ignorant of the motives of its steps, ever inconstant, yet forever the same. It repeated the paradox that gave it birth. Its restless and unstable stabilities recurred incessantly in the flow of time, and purposeful movements and unthinking forms betrayed the heavings of an imprisoned will. Waking and sleep lay locked in mutual arms. Helpless and indistinct came pleasure and pain, trembling with the first faint thrills of a world soul. Namaste, Jai Ma.